Welcome to Sea Views, and I'm really delighted today that I have Bill Moore from the P&I Club, the American Club. Bill is the Senior Vice President and Global Head of Loss Prevention. And Bill, it's 7 a.m. for you, so that's why I'm introducing you first, because I think you got the roughest deal here in time zones. Welcome.
No, thank you.
From the other side of the world, in Singapore at the moment, I've got Captain Eve Vandenborn at North Standard. And Eve is head of loss prevention, Asia Pacific region. And it's 7 p.m., so dinner time for you. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us with your flexibility in the time zones there. And Adam's joining me again from Chirp. And Adam, we've got the best deal because it's 11 a.m. coffee time for us, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So today we are talking about P&I and insurance and linking it really from the P&I perspective to safety, because that's what I'm quite interested to explore with you two. And it's brilliant that you both joined us, because both the American Club and North Standard, you know, you are both sort of very significant members of the international group of P&I clubs, and that's covering about 90% of all the world's shipping, isn't it? And I wondered if I could just start off with yourself, Bill. Welcome. And maybe give me a little bit of an overview of your role and how it links in with safety and insurance.
Thanks, Julia. Basically, all the P&I clubs, but I think North Standard is on the forefront of actually, you know, looking at loss prevention and safety-related issues for the maritime industry for decades now. But basically, I would say the P&I clubs started with really addressing safety with regard to condition surveys of ships. Every P&I club basically does condition surveys of vessels, usually at the age of 12 years or older if they enter the club. Sometimes we do it sooner, whatever reasons there may be. But basically what we do, it's a condition of cover for those vessels that are surveyed. They're looked at from a P&I perspective. There are various risks that are covered by P&I, and we can, you know, cover those issues momentarily. But the surveyors go on board. It's different from, or there are some similarities and overlaps with surveys that are done by classification societies. Not everything is the same. But we look at cargo worthiness and issues, for example, that classification societies don't look at, not to the degree that we do, as well as other safety-related items. But basically, it started, I would say that the safety-related focus of P&I clubs started there, and that was decades ago. It was way before Eve's and my time. Actually, I like that we did our history a few years back, and our ghostwriter assisted, and he basically found the first loss prevention person for the club, and this dated back to the early 1900s. So that particular focus has been around for some time for all.
Yeah, over 100 years. That's amazing.
Yes.
Thank you. And Eve, maybe it'd be lovely to just get your perspective on how your role is related to safety in the insurance world.
Thanks, Julia. I definitely agree with what Bill has said. The condition surveys are at the heart of where the risk lies for the P&I clubs. A bit on myself, I've been with the club now for 13 years. I started out with the Standard P&I club prior to the merger, where I was the global director of loss prevention for the last 10 years. And then with the merger with Nord at the beginning of this policy year, I changed my role. I'm now looking after the Asia Pacific region for loss prevention. And just maybe to build on to what Bill was saying, condition surveys, really important. But after that, we started expanding into really what kind of risks are we insuring in the P&I club? And should we be insuring certain risks? So we started from the loss prevention department to look into the underwriting side as well, or work closely with our underwriters to see, is this a big risk that you want to take on? Is this a good risk or not? We will look together with the claims department as well to see what were the historical claims for this particular member. We call our ship owners that we insure, we call them members. They are not necessarily clients. And we look at their past record and see if there is something where we can help, where we can assist them and make them improve their claims.
Yeah, and it's good that you get onto that issue there of how you select those. Move on to say how it was Adam that actually connected us all together, wasn't it, Adam, through Chirp?
Yeah, you're right. And the reason that I know both Eve and Bill is because of the thing that Eve has just said there about how the clubs are drivers for safety by looking at the risks and being able to discuss with their underwriters and then discuss with their members about how they drive down those claims. And in so doing, of course, they're improving safety. And I think the P&I clubs have a very strong role to play in that. And indeed, they do play that role, which is why I invited the both of them here today, because of their various perspectives, because of the, you know, we've got an American perspective, we've got an Asia Pacific perspective, and both, of course, are in the international group. So they can give us that great purview.
Yeah, it's really interesting to get the perspective from the insurance side of things on safety, because we're so often looking at it, you know, on a slightly more focused level per ship or per ship company. But obviously, you guys are seeing it on quite a big scale, aren't you? So I will be asking a few back to basics questions about P&I. What does it actually cover and what doesn't it cover? And I particularly also want to know about people and how the people and the crew and the seafarers fall into this as well.
I could start on that. Basically, there are a number of significant risks that are covered by P&I. I would say that primarily the major focus are on related to crew, on illness and injuries. Crew or anyone who's on board the ship, if a surveyor is on board and he's injured, or or stevedores are injured, of course, we cover that. So basically, it's anyone who's actually on board the ship affected by any incident that occurs on board the ship. The personal injury and illness are basically a rule of thumb, about a third of the frequency of our incidents and another third as far as costs. Then the second thing, which is about a third of our incidents and a third of our costs, are related to ship owners' interest in cargo. So basically, if there's an incident that occurs on board the ship that the ship owner is actually liable for, that damages the cargo. A good, easy example of that is, let's say, vessels loading rice in Thailand, for example, and the cargo hold hatch covers are open, and there's a storm that comes, a quickly approaching storm that comes, and they can't get the hatch covers closed fast enough. And let's say some of the rain damage affects the cargo. That's the ship owner's liability in that they were not able to get the cargo doors closed. So that would be something that would be very much a P&I related issue. And then there are a range of other issues and concerns. Pollution, for example, is another big issue, primarily, you know, oil pollution, those types of things, the cleanup related matters, those incidents. Then we have stowaways. We basically manage those types of cases. Then there's another significant issue is wreck removal. If a vessel, let's say, runs aground, a simple example, vessel runs aground, the vessel is able to be removed from the rocks. That's a salvage issue that's normally covered by hull and machinery. But if it becomes a wreck and it needs to be removed as a wreck, then that basically becomes a P&I related matter. There are other things. I could talk for an hour just on that, which I won't. But I would say those are primarily the most significant. Of course, there's deviations also. If you need to deviate for one reason or another, pick up someone who's, you know, another distressed vessel, or you have to deviate for any number of reasons, that's also the costs associated with that are also picked up by the P&I. Then there's something called freight defense and demurrage. Those are basically contractual issues. That's not directly a P&I. That's a separate cover, but it's handled by most P&I clubs, or all P&I clubs do some FD&D related issue. That's why we have our lawyers. A significant number of our lawyers deal with those matters. So that's a brief summary. There are other related risks. Maybe Eve might have others that I left out.
Thank you, Bill. That's really interesting. And I knew a bit about the pollution and the wreck side of it from my time working for Maritime and Coast Guard Agency. And that was probably where I would have had involvement, you know, with P&I clubs, is when it's gone
belly up.
Exactly. Yeah. But I didn't actually know that the people represented a third of the cost and the incidence. Do you see the same pattern, Eve? Is it roughly the same profile with your members as well then? Or is there extra things you'd pick up on as key?
I would say it's probably more or less similar for the majority of the P&I clubs within IG. The people claim tends to be about a third. Cargo claim tends to be between a third to half by number, not by value, but by number of claims. What we see as our biggest type of claim by value, then it's very low by number, but by value is all the navigation related claims. And that is one where we put quite a lot of our loss prevention focus on. If you are seeing those a ship somewhere hitting a bridge, a ship hitting another ship, or there was that big white one that went a couple of years ago in off the coast of Italy. So those kind of navigation related claims are covered by P&I clubs as well. Now, I just want to build on to one point that Bill mentioned, and I'm sure Bill will agree. When we are doing these, we quite regularly talk at seafarer conferences or workshops where we talk directly with the seafarer. When we start talking to them about the kind of personal injury and personal illness claims that we are covering for them, one of the default questions that we get is, oh, are you paying back my Rolex watch when I'm losing it? It's by default, we will get that question. So no, we will not pay back your Rolex watch unless you can produce a proper invoice for, I don't know what it is, $30,000 or something for a decent Rolex. Otherwise, we will not be paying that back when you lose your personal effects. So one of the differences for personnel claims as well is that they are very different from nationality to nationality. And from a P&I perspective, we pay back or we reimburse our owners for expenses as per the crew contract. So there is no common denominator between the various different types of reimbursements we do for crew. It very much is as per what is agreed between the ship owner and that seafarer in the crew contract. That is what we, from a P&I perspective, reimburse. Mm.
Okay. I mean, the people side of things, while we're talking about crew and seafarers, there's obviously the physical injuries as well. Have you seen an increase in issues related to mental health?
Definitely. If I'll go first, Bill, seafarer well-being is something that is definitely on the forefront now. And we are seeing an increase in that type of claims. Does that mean there really is an increase? Is another question. It might be that it is something that is finally getting the attention that it deserves and that is being reported more. And it can be that previously similar issues were happening, but seafarers were just simply not reporting them. So I think it is good that these things are now being reported and that the industry as a whole is putting the emphasis on well-being that it actually deserves. Maybe thank you to the pandemic as well, that definitely put the spotlight on it, on the importance of making sure that you have mental well-being in place, physical well-being, social well-being on board. I think that is a really good thing now in the industry. That said, there is a lot that still needs to be done by the industry to properly make sure that the seafarers are getting what basically we on the shore side are taking for granted.
Bill, could I ask you your perspective on the more mental health issue type side of things for seafarers?
Sure, glad to. If you don't mind, though, Julie, I'll take a step back because 20 years ago, what the American Club did is that we started a pre-employment medical examination program authorizing clinics that we believe will do a sufficient medical examination in those particular countries. That program has been extremely successful. That's probably as successful, if not more than successful, than our condition survey program. But it's basically a condition survey for the seafarer. And at one point in time, part of the examination was mental health related, but we found, no matter how we tried, all the different ways we tried, that I could count on probably two hands the number of incidents and cases of mental health that showed up during the pre-employment medical exam. They go to the clinic. They're there for half a day. There's nothing that can really be properly diagnosed under those particular conditions. So we've removed our mental health related component of our pre-employment medical exams and tried to refocus our attention on greater awareness. We have two mental health guys. We have another that will be released next week because our Safety Environmental Protection Committee of the club basically said they'd like for us to prepare something more directly related to, you know, if something happens on board a ship, what are the things that masters and fellow crewmen should be looking for as far as stressors and triggers? And then what should be done should there be an incident or something that they see may evolve into an incident? We struggle with mental health a bit and trying to really get our hands around it. We know it is an issue. How big of an issue it is, I'm sure Eve could tell you cases that he's had in his club, and I know that we've had incidents in our club. But they're relatively few that basically tell us, yes, this is a mental health-related issue. Mental health related incident. It's a bit of a challenge just getting our heads around incidents when they occur. But we do know it's an issue. We know it's out there. But how dramatic of an issue, that's still up for question.
And that could be a reporting thing, couldn't it?
It is, partially, yeah.
I think along with many other types of people-related incidents or near misses, a culture of reporting across the entire maritime industry really is quite low. And so I think Eve was right. I don't think the incidence of mental health, et cetera, have gone up. I think it's just being better recognized, more awareness. And certainly the guides that Bill discussed, we'll put them in the show notes, put a link to them, because by raising awareness, that does drive an increase in reporting. And, you know, reporting isn't just important for the individual seafarer, although clearly it is. It's also important for the industry because getting trend analyses and actually understanding the state of play across the entire maritime domain is the only way we're going to drive meaningful improvements.
Can I just add on to this point as well, that something that I mention quite regularly, when we are talking about types of claims, things that were happening, one thing we cannot forget, and I'm sure Bill is going to agree with me on this, I stopped sailing 20 years ago. It's a different generation that is at sea now. They have different priorities. They have different demands compared to when I was at sea. 20 years ago, internet didn't exist. I barely had a mobile phone in the days. I was totally normal that I could not contact my family for a couple of months because I didn't know any better. Now is a very different generation, and that's something that we need to recognize. This generation of seafarers, they want their well-being to be in order as it should. So they are making more demands and they are going to report on the issues if there are problems. So I think that is a change of generation, a change of focus, and that is causing all of the clubs now to similarly provide guidance on this.
Yeah, attitudes and expectations have definitely changed, haven't they, with each generation?
Oh, yeah.
There's quite a bit of discussion about bullying and harassment of seafarers at sea recently, and also women seafarers. So I know in cargo shipping, they probably only represent something like 1% of seafarers. We've seen reports and research that says they are actually suffering, you know, quite high levels of sexual harassment and sexual violence as well. I mean, would those become issues as well, or do become issues and covered by P&I as well? Eve, do you want to start off with that one?
Let me start off with the first part of the question. I think it is great that we are slowly, extremely slowly, starting to see more women in shipping. It is something that we need to try and push more. It's not just that we need to see women, though, and it is not just the females that are being harassed on board. That's one thing I would want to clarify. Anybody on board can get bullied, harassed. There are not just the gender, there is the sexual orientation, there is the religious aspect to it, there's cultural differences, and any of those can feel or get bullied by others on board. So it is something from a wider diversity and inclusion perspective that the industry needs to work on. And I think this is something where ship owners need to, first of all, have no tolerance if anybody does something that is not acceptable. And secondly, needs to provide guidance and training to the seafarers.
But again, it really starts at the top of the organization. It starts at the top on board the ship with regard to managing and making sure that, you know, not only harassment and bullying and sexual harassment too, of any form, is basically starts at the top of the organization. And definitely, it really is where the rubber meets the road is with the captain, the senior officers on board the ship. They have to be very well aware and very sensitive to these particular issues. There should be better training on that. I know the American Club is preparing some things on this now, particularly on the sexual harassment side. So, yeah, but I concur with Eve with regard. That's basically how it's handled on a P&I from a P&I perspective.
I'm glad you recognize that your perspective is that it has to come from the senior management and the shipping company, because there's quite a lot of talk about, can we train seafarers to be better at recognizing it and looking after themselves, which might help a bit, but they don't have a lot of power, do they, as an individual on a ship away from home? So, you know, it needs to be a sort of company-wide, sort of industry-wide thing, doesn't it? I'm going to throw in something else that I'm quite interested in. And I did do a podcast on this previously, which was green fuels and what's coming in the future and the move towards green fuels in shipping. Some of the fuels have got their own associated risks with them as well, for vessels, for ports and for seafarers, basically. Is this something that's big on the radar for P&I at the moment?
I think definitely. It's a major change coming that is happening within the maritime industry. We just recently at the IMO meeting in June this year, the regulation was even strengthened and the limits were brought forward. So there is a lot of work to be done for all the ship owners to be able to comply with these regulations and burn more green fuels. At the same time, nobody has a crystal ball. Nobody knows, is it going to be ammonia? Is it going to be methanol? Is it going to be hydrogen? Which is going to be the fuel of the future? Nobody knows. And likely it's going to be a combination of a number of them, depending on which area that the ship happens to be trading in. But like you were saying, each of these alternative fuels or green fuels carries their own risk with them. Definitely for a seafarer's perspective, whether it is toxic or like ammonia or explosive, those risks need to be calculated, need to be assessed. And that's something that from a P&I perspective, we are very much helping our members with. And we are providing guidance on decarbonization, on the various fuels, on the various requirements, the EU ETS or the Fuel EU or all the other CII regulations, etc., that are coming into force or that are in force. That is something that we are helping our members with, yes.
So that's a really interesting point. And one of the things that I've wondered about the P&I clubs, what is the role of the P&I club in that exchange of information, exchange of best practice? Because you're right, I think different fleets, different companies, different owners may go down different routes. So within a P&I club, you might have several members that have gone down the ammonia route, another couple of members that might have gone down, I don't know, the hydrogen or the methanol, or even, as I hear some people talking now, even the nuclear route, potentially. So is it the role of the P&I club to help exchange the ideas between the members? So is it sort of member-led, or is it run by the sort of, if you like, the P&I secretariat and with that more of a top-down approach?
Here's how we've basically addressed any technological change, any major regulatory impact, whether it's decarbonization, ballast water management, IMO 2020, whatever the subject may be, you know, scrubbers, you know, all these different, for lack of a better term, advancements in the industry. I basically say, okay, this particular matter, changing this regulatory environment is now becoming, you know, much more significant. And which I try to look at it through a P&I lens and say, okay, how does this affect P&I cover? The list of items that basically I mentioned before, and thanks, Eve, for basically, I completely forgot contact damage related claims, you know, contact and damage to third party property and collision and groundings and those types of things. That's a significant matter related to P&I also. But that list of items plus, you know, Eve's addition, Do these particular change or do these particular changes or these particular regulations have an impact on those risks that we cover? Do they, and do they have some sort of, you know, okay, scrubbers, that's a, I'll just use that as an example. Yes, scrubbers are, you know, part of the IMO 2020 with regard to sulfur, high sulfur fuels and the like. Okay, what additional risks do scrubbers add? They become a fire risk, there's a corrosion risk, these things, you know, pollution risks that may have an, you know, safety, let's say something happens with seafarer and the like. But the actual change or the actual issue, how does that impact the P&I, basically what we look at? Okay. One of the things, for example, the decarbonization issues right now, on the technical side, ship owners, they're very long-term thinking seafarers, but a lot of them, I'd say the vast majority of ship owners are just trying to get by today with the technologies they have available today. And the far off and the distant issues, you know, with new builds, there's going to be issues with financing green vessels, contracts right now, contracts and charter parties. That component, which is really an FD&D related matter to decarbonization, I think is important. That's something the clubs cover again, but that's not so much directly a P&I related matter at this point in time, as much as it is an FD&D, freight demurrage defense related matter. But we as P&I clubs, we are strongly supportive of all of our members, technology developments, things that we have that we're there to support them on. Do we lead that effort? No. Do we try to educate our members and keep them up to date? Yes. That's very important for us. But, and do we support our members in those initiatives? Yes. But are we the leading parties in that? No, we're not as the P&I clubs. I don't know what Eve may think. I see him kind of shaking his head in general agreement, I think, but I'll leave it to him to further opine on the matter.
I definitely agree with what you were saying, Bill, and I agree with how you explained that we are looking at how these new technologies are affecting the risks that we insure. And that's indeed the perspective of the guidance then as well that we are providing. We are not going to go and give an explanation on the technical use of ammonia on board. That is up to the classification society or up to the manufacturer of the engine to do so. And a simple Google search will give you 100 results of different organizations that are providing guidance on decarbonization. So I am going along with what Bill was saying. We will help our members with regards to how it affects the risks that we are insuring.
No, those are both great answers. And thank you for sort of explaining that. And that's a really good description of how it works, if you like, within each P&I club and that relationship between the P&I club and its members. But taking a step back, how does that then work across the industry? Is that the vehicle of the international group? How do you, if you like, rather than just intra P&I club, how is that expanded inter P&I club?
From an international group perspective, there is a working group on decarbonization that is looking into this as well. They have a different focus and they focus a lot more predominantly on the actual risks that we cover and whether or not or how the cover that all the clubs are providing, how that can or should not be amended. Do we have the right type of reinsurance within the IG group to cover these type of new technologies? Do we need to change any of the rules? Because all the 12 IG clubs are bound by the same P&I rules. Do any of these rules need to be changed? That is something that the IG will look at.
Yeah, no, that's, I agree with that. So the IG group, that's a really important point you just touched on there, Eve, about the rules being changed. Because I know that the IG have a significant voice at the IMO and other regulatory body, the agencies that actually make the rules.
The international group has an NGO status, same as several other organizations. I do not know if that equals an important or a big voice, but yes, the IG group has your status.
So on a similar topic, Bill, I was going to ask you, in your part of the world, there was a really appalling incident with a car carrier fairly recently, which was, it was carrying electric batteries, wasn't it? Which is becoming a much more common cargo. And I think two firefighters were lost. But is this something, again, that you've got to look at as a high risk type of cargo now? Do you have to sort of keep altering it as you go along? Or
yeah, the ion lithium battery issue with regards to cars, electric vehicles, as well as, you know, carrying on, you know, in containers and the like, that is a big concern and a risk. I will say, though, that the case that we had in Newark, that was not an electric vehicle, as people had expected.
Bit of misreporting then, potentially.
Yeah, there was some car which was trying to push another car, caught on fire. Details report, I'm sure, will be released soon enough by the Coast Guard or National Transportation Safety Board in the U.S. But that was a bit of a surprise. I expected that to be an electric vehicle. But electric vehicle concerns are huge for the industry. The American Club, we don't have too many car carrier related members. I'm sure Eve may have more to say about this. It is a concern. I don't know whether we didn't really touch on this matter, but it really is a concern for all the clubs, no matter how big they are and what their fleet profile look at, because we have what's called a pooling agreement. Any claim which is above $10 million up to, you know, just keep it simple, any claim above $10 million to $100 million at $90 million range is basically covered by all the P&I clubs. Basically, they pool that together. It's called part of what they call the pooling agreement. So if there's so basically affects us all either directly as being the club that covers that vessel, or indirectly as being, you know, a contributor to the pool claim. But it is a big issue. I think it might even be a bigger issue with container ships. You know, a large container ship, you know, 20,000 plus TEUs, and you have a fire in one of these containers in the middle of the cargo hold, and you got 14 seafarers to fight that fire. I think that might even be a bigger issue than the car carrier issue. The car carriers, of course, are much more significant because we see them, you know, they tend to show up, as we say, CNN. Those types of incidents. But Eva, maybe he has a further perspective on it, but it is a big issue.
I agree with what Bill was saying. The incident in Newark, I can't talk too much about, but it is correct what Bill said. And I think that is something that I will say in more general. Yes, lithium ion batteries are a problem. Runaway of batteries is an issue. The heat involved in lithium ion batteries is extreme compared to normal fires. They continue burning for a lot longer. They are a lot harder to extinguish, but they are not always the cause of the fire. However, if a lithium ion battery or an EV car is involved in a fire, regardless of how the fire was started, it will make it worse. And it will make it a lot harder to extinguish the fire and save the ship, basically. It's what Bill is saying. If you are on board with a group of 15 or 18 crew and you need to try and do the firefighting, that is not fun. Now, the IG has recognized this. The IG, and actually it was both the Legacy Nord and the Legacy Standard Club separately that came together and that put a new industry group together, which is called the Vehicle Carrier Safety Forum. And all the Nord Standard is now the IG representation on that industry body. There are a number of the major car carrier operators in this. There are experts involved, etc. And they are looking into providing guidance with regards to carriage of ICE, so the normal internal combustion engine type cars, and the EV cars. So this is something that is being looked into. Separately, there are other organizations looking into new firefighting methods. If you look at it, you will see people on a big car parking, open space, pulling a kind of a rug, I would say, over a car to extinguish the fire. That works really well, except that on a ship, you don't have the space to try and get in between a number of cars and put that over the burning one. So there are things being done to come up with new firefighting ways to extinguish these fires. There are also new battery types that are being produced in the market, which are less susceptible to thermal runoff, so that are less likely to cause the fire. So it is being looked at from a variety of different ways.
Yeah, I'm sorry, just to add one little point of the thermal runaway issue, particularly with lithium ion batteries, that they say the best way to fight those fires are with copious amounts of water. And of course, that doesn't sit well when that's great when you're doing that in a parking lot, you know, on land. It's a completely different matter, as we know, on board a ship.
Yeah, you want to generally keep the water outside, don't you?
Exactly.
This topic that we're talking about, it inevitably leads us to talk about worst case scenarios. That's the world you're working in. There's a lot of turmoil in the world at the moment. You know, there's the situation in Ukraine. There's Israel and Gaza region as well at the moment. I wondered, what is the definition, or how do you deal with that in terms of insurance for your members? So what if vessels are carrying aid to take to certain parts of the world? I mean, obviously, they may be going to risky areas. You know, do you protect them or support them? Or do they have to come off your books if they're going to what you might class as a war zone?
Yeah, basically, well, if it's considered a war zone or possible war zone, I mean, there's a separate P&I cover called war P&I. And that, again, we could talk for another hour on.
Okay, so that comes down to a definition thing of what's a war zone.
Yeah, there are, no disrespect to Eve, probably both of us are probably not as well qualified to talk about the details of that issue, but generally it is a covered issue. I mean, one thing we do see, like piracy and seafarers capture, that's considered, you know, normal P&I, and when they're released and there's, you know, PTSD-related issues, medical issues, that's normally covered under normal P&I. But for war zone-related matters, there are some issues about the, you know, Black Sea corridor and the like. We haven't seen any significant, we meaning, at least as far as I know, and this is, I think, for the IG in particular, we haven't seen any significant. We see cases where there's been vessels that have been hit by, you know, rockets and the like, you know, particularly early on in the conflict, but vessels that may be hit by mines and the like. But as far as I'm aware, that's covered under war risks, war P&I, which is separate from the normal P&I.
Some of the things I've read in sort of shipping media, and there's talk about a dark fleet of vessels that might be doing things that the international world doesn't want them to do anymore, such as carrying Russian oil and things like that. How does that work with members? Would they be covered, or would they have to be excluded? Say if an accident happened to them and they were doing something that, you know, internationally is considered illegal.
That's a really easy answer on that one, Julia.
Yeah.
The moment that a club becomes aware that a member or any ship owner that we have on risk is carrying a sanctionable cargo, whether it is from Russia or from any other, whether it is primary or secondary sanctions, the moment that we are aware of that, that ship is automatically off risk from the date that the cargo was loaded. So even if the incident happens, let's say today, we are notified of one of our members having a large oil spill, we find out that it is sanctionable cargo, then that ship is automatically off risk, backdated to when the cargo was loaded.
Oh, okay. That answers that one then.
I concur with Eve with regard to sanctionable cargoes and dark fleet. Once we're made aware of it, all bets are off and coverage is canceled based upon the incident or the circumstances. Yeah.
If I can add on to this, the dark fleet, those ships that are actually part of the dark fleet are most likely or most assuredly not insured by any of the IG clubs because of exactly the reason that we just said. They know that they would not have any cover. So they will go and look for their insurance elsewhere on a lower liability level. The risk, of course, with that is they will also go and seek different classification societies. They will go and seek different flag states that are willing to let them fly the flag. Any proper flag would never allow this to happen. So it also means, other than the fact that they are engaging themselves in illegal business, the standards and the safety on board of those ships are also no longer controlled or checked or verified by anyone.
Yeah.
So the risk of having an incident or a crew whether it is a crew injury or whether it's a collision or pollution, also becomes higher on that fleet.
Yeah, it's a problem. I usually have a wrap-up question, so I think we're getting towards that point. After we've talked about so many different ways that the P&I clubs have a perspective on safety, but are also trying to influence safety as well, I'm wondering if I could start with you, Eve, and ask you if there was one thing you thought you could change in terms of safety, what would it be to make an improvement? You only get one thing.
That's a difficult challenge. Yeah, it is. I need to think a second.
You take one, Eve, and then I'll take the next one. Yeah. I won't repeat what you said. Whatever. I got a couple in my mind, so I'll make whatever one you choose. I'll do the other one.
Let me go for the controversial one on this. And I've been asked this question recently during London International Shipping Week, and I also provided a controversial answer there. If there is one thing that I would want to change with regards to improving the safety on board of ships, it'll be minimum safe manning requirements. I feel that this is something that the minimum required crew on board to operate the vessel, just to sail it from A to B, should be, let me clarify that. Sailing a ship from A to B, as per what the minimum safe manning certificate requires, is fine. Except that ship owners are using that to also operate, maintain, do cargo operations, etc., which is not what is the definition of a minimum safe manning. So for me, that is something that should get clarified, that sailing from A to B requires X numbers. Operating the vessel, carrying cargo, doing maintenance, etc., requires Y number of seafarers. If we can do that, if we increase the number of seafarers on board, that will ultimately also help with the workload of the seafarers, that will help with the well-being of the seafarers, and that ultimately leads to safety improvement.
Adam and I are both nodding.
I'm going to jump in here because I'm grinning broadly, Eve, because in so many of our CHIRP reports, we actually highlight that minimum safe manning is below minimum for all the things you've just articulated there about the operating and the maintaining. So thank you. No, that's not controversial at all.
Great. Bill, it's your turn. So if you could make one change in terms of safety, what would it be?
I concur with Eve dramatically. And I would add on top of that, I think the biggest issue for us in this industry is the qualifications of seafarers. The qualifications and incentives for seafaring, it's not an easy life. There are benefits to it, seeing the world. But anyway, I would say the qualifications of seafarers, the training as seafarers, no matter how many of them are on board ship. I think that's a big issue. Things have changed on board ship. We've complained for some time, for decades, as long as I've been in this industry, I've heard complaints about qualifications of seafarers and the like. We've done a lot. One of the problems that we see, or one of the issues that I hear from time to time, is that the STCW standards are not keeping up with, what's really needed with seafarers as far as training and qualifications and soft skills.
Good. So you've solved a lot of issues here because you basically decided that we need the right number of seafarers for the job and really good quality seafarers. So that's going to solve a lot of things. I've really enjoyed having you with Adam and I today for Seaview's podcast. I think it's probably time for me to ring the bell and we will need to leave the bridge very carefully. We don't want any slips or trips. There'll be no incidents on the way off the bridge. And I'm really grateful for your time. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. And I'd like to follow that up as well, Julia, by saying not just thank you to Eve and Bill, but also to the American Club and to North Standard, because they've been longtime supporters of CHIRP Maritime's activities. And so I just want to say publicly, thank you very much to both you as individuals and to both of your clubs.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Julia, Adam, Eve.
Fishing vessel Great Pole, Coast Guard, we are reading you out and clear.